Imagine this scenario just for a second. It's a Friday afternoon.
Oh, the classic Friday deploy.
Right. You're about to click deploy on this major new application release. And on your screen, the user interface, I mean, it looks absolutely perfect.
Flawless.
Exactly. The demo was flawless. The marketing campaign is completely locked and loaded. Your executives are thrilled. But what you can't see, beneath that polished surface, is that a developer working 6,000 miles away.
Desperate to hit this exact deadline.
Yes, desperate for the deadline, just bypassed your entire security architecture to hard code a database password into like a hidden configuration file.
Just to make it work.
Just to make it work. So you are not launching a product, you are launching a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, tailored specifically for you, the learner. Today, our mission is to unpack a fascinating stack of research and strategic notes focused on one really critical imperative: preventing spaghetti code in distributed development strategies.
That Friday afternoon scenario, I mean, that is the exact nightmare keeping technical leaders awake at night.
Oh, for sure.
And we're dissecting a really widespread assumption today. Whenever a growing business experiences the unique, agonizing pain of a slow, buggy, completely unmaintainable application built by a distributed team, well, the immediate instinct is to blame the geography.
Right, yeah.
Leaders just assume that outsourcing naturally breeds poor quality code.
We hear that constantly. There's this pervasive myth that offshore automatically equals bad code. Okay, let's unpack this because digging into this material, we have to completely dismantle that assumption.
We really do.
The core argument here is that the physical location of your engineering team is never, literally never the actual culprit.
Right.
The root cause of all that structural decay comes down entirely to the delivery system surrounding those developers. Like if your architecture is unmanaged or your daily requirements are vague.
Or nobody owns the long-term maintainability.
Exactly. If nobody owns it, your code base is guaranteed to drift into chaos. And
Yeah.
that's regardless of whether your team sits in Bangalore, Eastern Europe, or, right down the hall in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, the physical distance simply amplifies the flaws in your operational system. It doesn't create them.
Right.
And what makes this structural decay so dangerous is the actual mechanism of how spaghetti code arrives. I mean, it rarely happens through one catastrophic failure, right? It's incredibly gradual.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Exactly. It almost always begins with the demand to ship just one urgent feature, usually driven by some aggressive business deadline.
Which we've all been there.
Right. And to hit that deadline, the team ships the feature without taking the time to refactor the existing code to properly accommodate it.
And that compromise creates a massive chain reaction.
Yeah.
Like a few weeks later, a different developer needs to build on top of that initial feature. But because the foundation wasn't updated, they have to write a quick workaround.
Just the quick patch.
Write a patch.
Yeah.
And this is where the fragmentation actually begins. Your core business logic, which really should be centralized and predictable, starts getting scattered everywhere.
It's a mess.
A calculation that should exist in one specific controller suddenly gets duplicated in a front-end template, and then it's buried inside a database stored procedure and finally patched with some floating script.
And the pressure to maintain delivery speed forces the team to skip writing automated tests for these workarounds.
Naturally.
So without tests, documentation instantly becomes obsolete. The developers themselves forget how all these fragmented pieces interact.
It's exactly like expanding a massive city grid without any zoning laws or master planning.
That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, like you realize you suddenly need a faster route downtown to accommodate traffic. But because there's no overall blueprint, you just pave a six-lane highway straight through a residential living room.
Yeah, whatever gets you there fastest.
Right. And eventually you reach a critical mass where trying to change one simple thing, like, I don't know, updating a tax rate or changing a logo, ends up breaking five seemingly unrelated systems.
What's fascinating here is that the initial phase of these projects is so incredibly deceptive.
Deceptive how?
Well, the first release of a distributed product almost always looks like a massive success. The customers can click through the main workflow, the data saves correctly, there are no visible errors on the screen.
Everything looks fine.
Right. The trap isn't sprung during version one. The trap is sprung much later, usually when the business urgently needs to, say, scale user capacity or integrate a third-party payment gateway or patch a critical security vulnerability,
ah,
that is the exact moment you realize the code base fundamentally resists change.
And that actually brings up a really fascinating psychological element covered in our source material.
Hmm.
The notes refer to this dynamic as the founder's blind spot. So we're shifting here from the physical mechanics of the software to the psychological reality of management. If this inevitable decay is so destructive, why are smart, highly capable business leaders consistently blindsided by it?
Because business leaders naturally evaluate progress using the signals that are visible and familiar to them.
Right, things they can measure.
Exactly. They watch the weekly video demos, they count the number of screens delivered, they track how many tickets were closed in Jira or whatever project management software, and they review the hours billed against their budget.
Makes sense.
But those signals are entirely decoupled from architectural health.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
Because I think a lot of non-technical founders listening to this might feel entirely justified in using those metrics. Like, if I hire a distributed team and the application they deliver looks beautiful, functions smoothly in the browser, and the invoicing aligns perfectly with our initial contract, hasn't the market spoken?
I hear this all the time.
Right. Like, why should a CEO care if there happens to be duplicated logic hidden somewhere in the back end?
A CEO must care because hidden duplicated logic is not merely an engineering complaint. It is a literal financial liability.
Wow. Excellent.
That beautiful functional UI can completely mask weak permission boundaries. A button might be hidden from a regular user, but without back-end validation, an attacker can still trigger the action.
Just bypass the UI entirely.
Exactly. The UI hides the absence of automated tests and the presence of hard-coded assumptions that will just instantly shatter the second your application hits real user volume.
Right.
For a non-technical leader, relying solely on a polished UI is like buying a business based solely on its marketing brochures without ever looking at the balance sheet.
Okay, that makes total sense.
Hmm.
But if you are that non-technical founder and you are relying entirely on a lead engineer or, you know, an agency for technical execution, you don't even know what you don't know.
Exactly.
So how do you actually audit the structural health of a system without needing a computer science degree to read the raw code?
You have to force the engineering team to prove their structural health by asking highly specific proxy questions.
Proxy questions.
Yeah. These questions translate technical architecture into visible business risk. For instance, put your lead developer in the hot seat.
Okay.
Ask them, if our current vendor disappeared tomorrow, could an entirely new team understand and deploy this module based solely on the documentation?
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant stress test.
It really exposes the reality.
And another crucial proxy question from the notes is asking about deployment. Like, can the team deploy the application to a brand new server environment with a single automated script?
Yes.
Or does it require an engineer to spend 3 days manually tweaking configurations and moving files around?
That's exactly the kind of scrutiny required. You also must ask if credentials and API keys are protected in a secure vault, or if they're just sitting in plain text inside the repository for anyone to find.
Yikes.
You ask if the absolute most critical revenue-generating paths in the software are covered by automated tests that run on every single change. By asking these targeted questions, a leader forces the focus away from the cosmetic demo and directly onto the invisible architecture.
And taking that concept of control even further, the material moves into structural solutions next. Starting with what feels like the most critical vulnerability for any company using an offshore model intellectual property control.
Oh, absolutely.
The stance here in the research is absolute. The client must own the repositories, the cloud hosting accounts, the deployment credentials, and all project management records.
It is staggering how many businesses fail at this specific operational hurdle.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Intellectual property protection is not just a non-disclosure agreement you sign at the beginning of a vendor relationship.
Right. It's not a piece of paper.
No. It is a daily, rigorous operational practice. If your entire application lives inside an AWS account registered to your offshore vendor's generic admin email, you have effectively handed over a hostage.
You completely lose all leverage over your own product.
Entirely.
So the mechanics of this control need to be airtight. Access to these systems must be explicitly role-based, meaning, you know, a front-end developer shouldn't have administrative access to the production database.
Never.
And the access must be reviewed consistently and, crucially, revoked the absolute second the contributor leaves the project.
Yeah, that happens way too often where old accounts stay active.
Right. and you must enforce multi-factor authentication across the board and demand individual logins. Shared generic logins are an absolute liability when you need to audit who made a catastrophic change.
Yeah, owning the keys to the infrastructure is just the baseline, but simply holding the keys does not guarantee the software inside that infrastructure is built correctly.
Right, the house still might be falling apart.
Exactly, and this is where the concept of a named architecture owner becomes absolutely non-negotiable.
Okay, I want to dive into this because without a single defined architect, you end up with what the notes describe as developers optimizing entirely for local ticket completion.
Yeah, and that is just the natural human tendency in a distributed environment.
Sure.
If you hand 10 different developers 10 different tickets without an overarching architectural blueprint, they will solve those problems using 10 completely different design patterns.
Which creates the spaghetti.
Exactly. One developer uses one library for database queries, another uses something entirely different. A named architecture owner exists to prevent that chaos. They're the single point of accountability who dictates the overarching patterns, enforces security standards, and reviews major technical decisions to ensure system coherence.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
The text introduces this idea of the hybrid model, and it shatters this false dichotomy that businesses either have to hire vastly expensive, fully local in-house engineering teams, or they just have to resign themselves to the wild west of unmanaged outsourcing.
Right, doesn't have to be one or the other.
Exactly. The hybrid model suggests utilizing senior, local architecture, and product leadership, the people who deeply understand the business goals, to firmly dictate the design and security requirements.
And once those strict guardrails are established by the local leaders, you bring in the distributed or offshore team to add massive speed and execution capacity.
It's the best of both worlds.
It really is. This model aligns perfectly with modern startup methodologies, even AI native development practices.
Oh, definitely.
The objective is never to avoid global talent. The objective is to provide that global talent with a system that guarantees maintainability. You are outsourcing capacity, but you are never ever outsourcing responsibility.
Right. You provide the master zoning laws before the construction crews ever break ground.
Love that analogy.
So assuming we've secured our repositories and we've appointed our architecture owner, we need to examine the actual front lines of this process.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the daily ticket grind. Because even with a great architect, if the day-to-day communication breaks down, the code rots.
The day-to-day execution is where the grand architectural vision survives or dies.
Yeah.
And the failure usually begins before a single line of code is written, specifically within vague requirements. If a product manager writes a ticket that simply says, improve user onboarding, they have fundamentally failed the development team.
And the mechanics of that failure are fascinating to me. Because when a developer receives a vague ticket like improve onboarding, they are forced to guess what the business actually wants.
And guessing is dangerous.
Very. That guess translates directly into code.
Mm-hmm.
They might hard code a specific user path that bypasses your main routing logic entirely, just because they didn't understand the broader system implications.
Right.
So to prevent this, the research insists that tickets must definitively outline the user role, the exact desired behavior, the validation rules for every single input, the specific error states, the analytics events to track, and the precise permission boundaries.
Because when you remove the guesswork, you remove the necessity for rogue workarounds. Clear requirements also make the next critical step, which is code review, infinitely more effective. Code review in a distributed environment cannot merely be a rubber stamp confirming that the feature works on the developer's local machine.
No. A code review has to be an audit.
Yes.
The notes emphasize that teams must examine readability, structural performance, and security. Reviewers should actually be cross-referencing industry standards, like the OWASP secure coding practices.
They have to.
They have to actively hunt for unclear variable naming or swallowed error messages that will make debugging completely impossible later and unvalidated data inputs. These are the subtle flaws that keep the UI looking perfect while completely hollowing out the core.
And this rigorous review process naturally leads us to the most contested element of daily development automated testing.
Oh, testing.
Yeah. The mandate here is to ruthlessly prioritize testing for critical workflows. Login systems, role-based permissions, billing integrations, data creation, and critical exports must be covered. Anything that handles customer trust requires an automated test.
Okay, wait, let me stop you there.
Uh-oh.
Because if I'm a startup founder listening to this, my blood pressure is rising a little.
I can imagine.
If we are mandating a WASP-level security audits, hyper-detailed ticketing, and comprehensive automated test suites for every single pull request, my team's delivery velocity is going to flatline.
Right.
In a competitive market where speed is literal survival, how do you justify pumping the brakes this hard?
This raises an important question, and it's actually the most common objection in software development, but it's based on a fundamental illusion.
An illusion?
Yes. Missing tests and skipping reviews do not actually speed up development. They only speed up the very first release. What they do is severely and sometimes permanently paralyze future delivery. We have to completely reframe how we view this process.
Well, explain the mechanism behind that paralysis. Mm-hmm. Like, why does the speed just disappear?
Because without an automated test suite acting as a safety net, every subsequent modification to the code base becomes a high-risk operation.
Every single change.
Every change. Developers lose confidence. When they add a new feature, they have no idea if they just inadvertently broke the billing system.
Right, they're terrified to touch anything.
Exactly. Consequently, they spend hours manually clicking through old workflows, attempting to verify everything. Or worse, they deploy blind and spend days fixing regressions, which are just previously solved bugs that have resurrected.
Nightmare.
Technical debt compounds exponentially. Mm-hmm. A test suite is not a tax on your time. It is an investment in future velocity. Over time, that safety net is what empowers a team to move rapidly without the constant friction of second-guessing their own system.
Wow, that paradigm shift changes the entire conversation. You aren't losing time. You're prepaying for future speed.
Perfectly said.
Now, all these technical strategies are brilliant in theory, right? Mm. But technology does not exist in a vacuum.
No, it doesn't.
It requires budget, and it requires internal company alignment. How do technical leaders compel the rest of the business to care about this invisible architecture?
Well, you have to translate technical realities into stark business realities.
Right.
The source material specifically highlights businesses in Orange County as an illustrative case study. Orange County represents a highly competitive, premium local market where the baseline expectations are incredibly high.
Very high.
Whether you're dealing with patients, B2B partners, or direct consumers, they all demand a flawless, highly secure digital experience.
And in a high-stakes environment like that, spaghetti code operates like a dormant fault line.
Oh, yeah.
On an average Tuesday, everything seems fine. But the system catastrophically fractures during moments of extreme stress. Like a sudden viral traffic spike, a rigorous compliance audit, or an aggressive Black Friday marketing push.
That's when it all falls apart.
The weak architectural foundation becomes entirely visible to the public.
And internally, the warning signs preceding those public failures are always present. You just have to know how to spot the friction.
What does that look like?
Leadership should be looking for teams heavily relying on manual workarounds to complete basic tasks. You look for employees actively avoiding certain internal systems or reporting tools because they simply do not trust the data output.
Like putting buckets under a leaky roof instead of just fixing the shingles.
Exactly.
And when you identify those symptoms, the challenge becomes securing the budget to fix them. If your IT department frames this as a desperate, highly technical rescue mission to, you know, refactor the monolithic controllers,
the finance department will shut that down immediately.
They will label it as an optional technical upgrade and deny the funding. The text is very clear. You must translate these issues into revenue risk. You request budget to mitigate compliance violations, protect the existing customer base from data breaches, and ensure the upcoming marketing launch doesn't crash the servers.
Yes. You must clearly separate urgent risk reduction, which is about protecting the systems and revenue you currently hold, from strategic enhancements, which are about building new automation for the future.
Make the distinction clear.
And prioritization requires objective evidence. You analyze system logs, aggregate support tickets, and review user feedback. You cannot simply allocate budget to whichever department is complaining the loudest that week.
Reacting to the loudest complaint is just a recipe for endless firefighting.
Endless.
To fundamentally solve the structural flaws, the research recommends implementing a strict 30-day review cycle. You isolate one specific problem, assign one clear owner, define a baseline, apply your architectural fixes, and review the outcome in exactly 30 days.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, crucially, the scorecard for that review must remain remarkably simple.
Keep it simple.
Avoid the temptation to build a massive, complex dashboard of vanity metrics. Limit the review to 3 to 5 maximum measurements. Ask things like, Did our incident rate drop? Are our feature delivery cycles measurably shorter? Has the rate of code rework decreased?
And tying this massive operational shift together requires one final, highly practical step: documentation.
Ah, documentation.
But we are not talking about enormous, bloated corporate wikis that take months to write and are instantly ignored by the engineering team.
No, theoretical documentation is useless. What is required are concise operating notes, actionable checklists for deployment and security reviews, and a transparent list detailing exactly who owns which system component.
Because institutional memory fades incredibly fast, and employees inevitably transition out of the company.
It happens all the time.
Practical documentation guarantees that the business relies on repeatable, structured processes rather than the fragile memory of one specific senior developer who happens to know where the metaphorical bodies are buried in the code base.
Right. It ensures continuity. When a new developer joins the distributed team, they are handed a reliable map instead of being dropped into a labyrinth and told to guess the way out.
So what does this all mean? Taking all of these strategies into account, it radically shifts the perspective on scaling a tech product.
It really does.
For you, the listener, the ultimate takeaway is clear. Distributed development is an incredibly potent mechanism for growth, but its success is entirely contingent on a flawless delivery framework. You must fiercely protect your intellectual property at the repository level.
Essential.
You must empower a named architecture owner to enforce system coherence. You must eliminate guesswork with rigorous, testable requirements, and you must tie your technical investments directly to tangible business outcomes.
Yeah.
The physical location of the developers is irrelevant. The system you construct around them dictates your fate.
It ultimately comes down to designing systemic accountability. And as digital infrastructure continues to fundamentally underpin every aspect of modern commerce, consider this final implication drawn directly from our discussion on translating code quality to business risk. What if, in the very near future, the valuation of a company during a merger or acquisition is determined not just by auditing its recurring revenue or user acquisition cost, but through a brutal, deep dive technical audit of its code base? If spaghetti code evolves from an engineering headache into a literal quantified liability line item on a corporate balance sheet, drastically reducing a company's sale price, how much hidden, unmeasured technical debt is your organization carrying right now?
That is a staggering thought experiment for any founder or executive to grapple with. It entirely redefines the actual value of what you are building.
It changes everything.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the invisible architecture of your business. Remember, the true shortcut to moving fast in software development isn't skipping the planning phase. The fastest way to move is to build the foundation correctly the first time. Keep learning, keep questioning your systems, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.